Good morning. Good to be with you today. So glad to see you. I hope you will have your Bible open to Acts chapter 27. If you don't already, we're going to spend all of our time there today. When you find something good and you weren't looking for it, some people call that luck. Some people call it serendipity. It's how we found penicillin. It's how the microwave was invented. It's how we got post-it notes. What's it called when you get what you wanted, but it isn't everything it was cracked up to be? We have a lot of terms for that. Anticlimactic would be one of them. Someone says it's called situational irony. Some have referred to that as aspirational regret. But what's it called when you want something and you get it, but it didn't come the way you thought it was going to? If you're a child of God, you might call it the providence of God. At least if we were reading this account in Acts chapter 27, that's probably what we would call it. A couple of years before the events that are recorded in Acts 27 and 28, the last two chapters of that phenomenal volume, Paul wrote these words to the church at Rome in Romans chapter 1, verses 8 through 10. First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, because your faith is being proclaimed throughout the world. For God, whom I serve in my spirit in the preaching of the gospel of his Son, is my witness as how to unceasingly I make mention of you, always in my prayers, requesting, if perhaps now, at last, by the will of God, I will succeed in coming to you. Paul really wanted to go to Rome. Paul didn't found the church at Rome. Someone else did. But Paul was thankful that there was a church of the Lord in Rome, and he wanted to go. And he wrote one of the most significant pieces of New Testament literature, the letter to the Romans. And he told them how much he had been praying to God that God would make a way for him. And I can only imagine, since Paul at that time had been various places throughout the Roman Empire, all through Asia Minor and Greece and all over the region of Israel, which then was, of course, occupied by Rome. They were Roman territories at that point. I mean, Paul had been everywhere, man, like the old song said, but he hadn't been to Rome. And so he prayed that God would take him to Rome. I don't think he ever envisioned that the way that he would get to Rome would be via shipwreck. Although in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul reveals that he was shipwrecked not once, not twice, but three times, all in service to Christ. So a couple of years later, God finally granted this prayer, and Paul arrived in Rome, but not as a free man wandering about Rome, checking in on the church there, but rather as a prisoner where people would have to come visit him. He had faced almost an identical fate as Jesus. If you read the full record, obviously we don't have time for that today. But if you go back to about chapter 22 of the book of Acts and read forward to this point, you'll see that Paul, at the end of one of his missionary journeys, came back to Jerusalem. And there, in sharing the gospel, it became evident that Paul was about as much of a problem as Jesus had been some years before. And they probably would have taken him out and stoned him if they could have, just like they would have with Jesus. But of course, what happened with Paul was a little different. You see, Paul was something that Jesus wasn't, which is Hard to believe. You would think that there's nobody that could be anything that Jesus wasn't besides a sinner. But Paul was a Roman citizen, and Jesus wasn't. Yeah, he lived in the Empire of Rome, Jesus did, but he wasn't a Roman citizen. But Paul was a born, free Roman citizen with all the rights and privileges of Rome. And so when it became clear that Paul was not going to get a fair trial, his only crime was preaching the gospel and stirring up a lot of people and creating a lot of dissension by virtue of his preaching between essentially non-spiritual Jews and spiritual Jews in Jerusalem, and probably some that Paul once knew in his former days. So when it became clear to him that he wasn't going to get a fair trial and that Festus wasn't going to help him out, he appealed his case to Rome, something only a Roman citizen could do. Paul actually represented himself. He was a lawyer. No surprise there. But he was a trained lawyer, and he represented himself a couple of times going before the leaders of Rome, before Festus, and even before Agrippa. And Agrippa marveled at him. In fact, Agrippa, in the deliberations that took place after the interview with Paul or the interrogation of Paul, basically said, well, if he hadn't appealed to Rome, we could have set him free. But Paul wanted to be vindicated, and he had the right as a citizen to do that. And so he was sent to holding in Caesarea, en route ultimately to Rome. And Acts chapter 27 and 28 contain that voyage. Now, Paul was put on first a smaller ship that would sail just up the coast, and then a little bit later that ship ends up harboring somewhere else, and they pick up another ship. This one is a grain vessel from Egypt. And on that grain vessel were soldiers. There was a centurion on the ship, and a centurion was he commandeered 100 soldiers. And there were also prisoners on the ship along with the cargo. We don't know how many prisoners, but we do find out in Acts 27 that all in, there were 276 souls on board, and Paul was one of the prisoners. Now, Paul had some privileges that other prisoners would have never had, and part of that probably was because of his relationship to some powerful people. Paul was able to have companions with him, one of which was Luke. Another one was a man by the name of Aristarchus. Paul was also able to leave that company and go see other folks at one of the places where they were in port, and the reason for that had to be because he had some special status, particularly as a Roman citizen, but nonetheless. Acts chapter 27 and 28 is the record of him ultimately getting to Rome, probably not the way he had envisioned at all. Luke spends an inordinate amount of time and spares no expense as far as detail is concerned in this record of Acts 27. Acts 27 in particular deals with Paul getting from the beginning of his voyage in Caesarea until they shipwreck on the island of Malta. It's one of the most, if not the most, specific, detailed maritime accounts in ancient literature. And for the sake of time, we can't deal with any more background. The voyage is not only a matter of historical interest regarding the life of Paul and the early Christian movement. It also is a template that is absolutely brimming with lessons of faith and life. And as many of those lessons as I have to share with you today, there are literally dozens more that we will see along the way or you will notice. So certainly go back when you have time and look into this. Now, maybe on Paul's journey, I'm sure there were some beacons along the way to help those who were traveling on the waters. There are still beacons today to help those who are traveling on the waters. The most famous type of beacon, I'm sure, is a lighthouse. But of course, we have all kinds of technology these days that's probably far better than a lighthouse. But lighthouses can still be very important. But there are all kinds of things, all kinds of signs and buoys and floaty things and and lighthouses and other such things. And as we travel through this chapter, that's what I would like for us to envision along the way. I would like for us to envision that popping up out of the water are some beacons, maybe some markers or some buoys of some sort, and on them they will have signs. And each of these signs will give us a lesson that we will draw from the account and the events of Acts chapter 27. So I hope you'll travel with me. The first beacon that we're going to see is one that has a sign on it that says, "Beware the limitation of human wisdom." Beware the limitation of human wisdom. There's a key phrase that is in verse 20 of Acts 27. I'm going to share the key phrases for each of these with you first, and then we're going to go back and read the corresponding text. But the key phrase in verse 20 is, "All hope of our being saved was at last abandoned." This is going to be the longest single reading that we do together, and it's really going to set the stage for the rest of the lesson. We're going to start back in verse 1, and I'll have you follow along with me. So, I'm in 26, that's why it didn't sound right. Okay, chapter 27 and verse 1. "And when it was decided that we should sail for Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. And embarking in a ship of Adramidium, which was about to sail to the ports along the coast of Asia, we put to sea accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica. The next day, we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go to his friends and be cared for. And putting out to sea from there, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us. And when we had sailed across the open sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia," by the way, Paul was from Cilicia, you might remember, "we came to Myra and Lycia. There the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing for Italy and put us on board. We sailed slowly for a number of days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus, and the wind did not allow us to go farther. We sailed under the lee of Crete off Salmone. Coasting along it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lasia. Since much time had passed, and the voyage was now dangerous because even the fast was already over." That, by the way, dates the account to late September because of the fast that is spoken of here, the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. "So Paul advised them in verse 10, saying, 'Sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives.'" Now, Paul's a prisoner talking to the captain of the ship, talking to people who are out on the seas all the time. And it's not that they don't know, but they've got a big cargo. And if they can make this run late in the season when everybody else is off the water, you know how that goes. It's a gamble. Paul's not much of a gambler. The centurion, it says in verse 11, paid more attention to the pilot and the owner of the ship than to what Paul said. Listen, you can't discredit them for that. Who are you going to listen to? This prisoner? Or the people who are truly out on the water all the time? But you see, Paul represents something, and we'll get to that a little bit later. Verse 12, "And because the harbor was not suitable to spend the winter in, the majority decided to put out to sea from there on the chance that somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete facing both southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there." Well, look at verse 13. Now when the south wind blew gently, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, they weighed anchor and sailed along Crete close to the shore. Well, everyone's in agreement, or at least the majority is in agreement. It's going to be better to go winter somewhere else than it is here. We'd like to get further than not so far. And once we let up the anchors and start to go, there's a soft wind blowing at our back. This is perfect. Just as we thought, the gamble is going to pay off. Now, if you've read Acts 27, spoiler alert, the gamble doesn't pay off, at least not quite the way they thought. Verse 14, but soon a tempestuous wind called, and some translations give you the Greek term Euroclydon, the northeaster, struck down from the land. And when the ship was caught and could not face the wind, it only had one large rectangular sail, so they couldn't go into the wind with it. We gave way to it and were driven along. Already, if you're spiritual, I think you can envision what the lessons might be here. Running under the lee of a small island called Cauda, we managed with difficulty to secure the ship's boat. After hoisting it up, they used supports to undergird the ship. Then, fearing they would run aground on the Syrtis, they lowered the gear, and thus they were driven along. Since we were violently storm-tossed, they began the next day to jettison the cargo. And on the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard, which was, by the way, not fishing poles and bobbers. It was anything that wasn't bolted down. They began throwing the tackle overboard with their own hands. And look at verse 20. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest lay on us, all our hope of being saved was at last abandoned. Wow, did that turn quickly. And of course, in verse 21, people disagree on what the tone of voice might be, so you can read into it what you want. I don't know exactly what kind of person Paul was, and if there was a little bit of sarcasm in his voice or not, or frustration or anger or some combination of all of them. But look at what he says to them in verse 21. Since they had been without food for a long time, Paul stood up among them and said, "Men, you should have listened to me." Well, he wasn't exactly Monday morning quarterbacking. He did say something from the start. And what he was afraid was going to happen, happened. And I just wonder if those other two shipwrecks hadn't happened before this in very similar circumstances. You should have listened to me and not set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. There's a saying in high altitude mountaineering that you should listen to what the mountain is telling you. I just saw, just this past week, one of the craziest things I've ever seen. I've been interested in Mount Everest for years, or high altitude mountaineering for that matter, but Everest in particular and K2. K2 is ridiculously more dangerous than Mount Everest is. Of course, Mount Everest has become a kind of weird commercial death trap. But I saw last week that Red Bull, which gives you wings apparently, Red Bull sponsored a man after season, because you can only summit Everest for about a 1 month window. That's it. So we're already out of that season and have been for months. They sponsored a fella to climb Everest with a Sherpa and ski back down. And by the way, climb with no supplemental oxygen and ski back down Everest. And he did it. Remarkable. It's insane, but it's remarkable. They say you should listen to the mountain. Only go up if it invites you up. But of course, a lot of people spend $100,000, $200,000 to pay these expedition services to get up there, and they spend months, if not years, training to do it and waiting to do it. And so with all of that time, attention, and money on the line, what are you going to do if the mountain isn't inviting you? Are you just going to turn around and go home? Well, yeah, rational people, that's what we would do. Rational people wouldn't do it to begin with, perhaps. But many people don't listen to the mountains. And I'm sure many people don't listen to the seas either. There was a payday at hand. Most people aren't out in the shipping lanes at this time of year. Notoriously bad weather. Notorious for this kind of event. Paul knows this. They know this, but Paul's motive isn't the same as theirs. If they can get one more paycheck in. Yeah? So let's not act like they're over there and we're over here. We've never done anything stupid for a little extra money for another paycheck. I'm sure some of us have. So you can at least sympathize. But beware the limit of human wisdom. The centurion was more persuaded by the pilot and the captain of the ship than what was being said by Paul. And it just reminds me of what Paul represents. He represents the voice of wisdom and the voice of God. Even though they don't understand that yet, they will. But when following worldly wisdom, the soft wind may blow for a while. But before long, all hope of being saved will be gradually abandoned. Now, the second beacon that we reach says, return to God. Return to God. In verse 22, Paul says to them, there will be no loss of life, only the ship, if they'll listen to his voice. So again, going back to verse 21, since they had been without food for a long time, Paul stood up among them and said, men, you should have listened to me and not set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. Yet now I urge you, take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. Why? Why would he say that? Verse 23, for this very night there stood before me, or beside me, an angel of God, to whom I belong and whom I serve. And he said, do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. Not only was Paul going to get to Rome, and not only was Paul going to get to Rome in a manner in which he could have never imagined, but he's actually going to have an audience with the household of Caesar. And he later writes about this in the book of Philippians, chapter 1, where he writes to the church at Philippi, which he had founded some years before, and said, I'm seeing now that the things which have happened to me have come out to the furtherance of the gospel. I've been able to preach the gospel even to those of Caesar's household. Paul could have never imagined. But note, Paul says, there's going to be a loss of the ship. There will be no loss of life if you listen, but there will be a loss of the ship. In returning to God, it is certainly a principle that it's probably going to get worse before it gets better. If we haven't heeded the word of the Lord, if we haven't paid attention to what God has said, even when we repent, even when we change our mind, even when we change our heart, sometimes those things are going to follow us in this life. And it may get worse before it gets better. It did ultimately get better, but not before it got a lot worse. Sometimes the cost of safety with God is the loss of the ship. And if that's the case, then so be it. Jesus said, if your hand or your foot causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to enter life crippled or lame than to have two hands and two feet thrown into eternal fire. If your eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to enter life with one eye than to have two eyes and to be thrown in the fires of hell. Matthew 18, 8 and 9. The third beacon that we see along the way says, owned by God. Back to verse 23, Paul says, an angel of the Lord stood by him, an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve and of whose I am a slave, really. Paul's favorite word to describe his relationship to Jesus was a slave. In fact, that is the most prolific term that is used to describe a Christian in the New Testament. Not a house servant, a slave, a bond slave. A slave is someone who is owned by another, who has effectively no name of their own, who has no rights of their own, who owns nothing themselves. A slave is owned, a piece of property to be transacted upon. That's the imagery that Paul uses to describe himself. Certainly he knew what slaves were. The Roman Empire was full of slaves, people who were owned by others. Paul says, that's my relationship with Jesus Christ. In fact, the only way to survive the storm is to be owned by Christ. And what about us? Do we trust our master enough to let him do with us as he pleases? I can only imagine. I've never been in a situation like this, and I hope to never be in a situation like this. And I know a really good way to never get in a situation like this, and that's to never get on the ship in the first place. So I know I can avoid this tragedy. I'm almost certain. But what would we do? We would probably do the very things that they would do. We would probably be of a mind to get rid of everything, and then at the last minute we would throw ourselves into the water. We would try to do something because we like to take control of the situation. Certainly the last thing we would want to do would be to stay in the ship after they've been weeks going through this storm. It'd be the last place you want to be. Paul says you got to stay on board. I trust God. He doesn't merely say, I believe in God. I mean, a lot of people believe in God. That's what you get with the Pew surveys where it says 87% of Americans believe in God. Well, whoop-de-doo. A lot of people have believed in God from the beginning. Most people don't just outright deny the idea that we're not God and that there's a creator of all of us. That couldn't be anything further almost from the idea of whether or not we believe God. Some translations say, I trust God. A lot of people believe in God, have almost no trust in God. Paul says, I trust God that whatever he says will be, that's what's going to be. Paul was owned by God. The fourth beacon we're going to see has a sign on it that says, walk with God. Now we go a little further down in the text here. In verse 24, behold, God, the angel tells Paul at the very end of that verse, God has granted you all those who sail with you. So take heart, men. I believe, God, that it will be exactly as I have been told. But we must run aground on some island. And indeed, eventually they did. But going further now in verse 27, when the 14th night had come as we were being driven across the Adriatic, about midnight, the sailors suspected they were nearing land, so they took a sounding, checking the depth, if you don't know what that is, and found 20 fathoms. A little further, they took a sounding again and found 15 fathoms. That's about 120 feet, and now 90 feet. And fearing we might run on the rocks, they let down 4 anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship and had lowered the ship's boat into the sea under pretense of laying out anchors, where are you guys going? Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. Well, you know, by this time, sailors notoriously superstitious. Paul did warn that this was going to happen, not that it wasn't a natural occurrence anyway, but apparently it frightened them enough to stop and take notice. What a force and what a presence Paul the Apostle must have been. I don't know that there's any event in Paul's life that we know about that demonstrates his character, his presence, and his power in the hands of a mighty God than this. Paul essentially commandeered this ship single-handedly. Storms happen in our lives. We need to stay in the ship. We need to walk with God. The answer to life's difficulties is not to abandon God. So many people do it. The answer to life's difficulties is not to abandon the comfort and the harbor of God's people. So many people do it. The answer in the storm is to stay in the ship. God is protecting the ship. If you go overboard, you're on your own. Do you trust God or do you not trust God? Stay in the ship. Satan has shipwrecked many souls by isolating them from God's family. Either we believe God or we don't. Beacon number 5 says, fight for God. In verse 32, which we just read a moment ago, the soldiers cut away the ropes. Well, in your relationship with God, there will be sailors and there will be soldiers, and no discredit to those sailors among us. But there will be sailors and there will be soldiers. In verse 30, the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship. And when Paul brought it to the attention of the centurion, in verse 32, the soldiers cut away the ropes of the boat, their escape plan. In the fight for your relationship with God, there are sailors and there are soldiers. There are those that are looking for a shortcut and those that are only looking out for themselves. Beware. Be a soldier. Stand up for your fight with God. Stand up for your brothers and sisters. Stand up for what is right. Fight for your relationship with God. Fight for what is right and fight for the truth. You don't have to pay the price for your salvation, but you do have to fight for your soul. The 6th beacon says, represent God. This one is interesting. Beginning in verse 33, as day was about to dawn, Paul urged them all to take some food, saying, this is the second week, the 14th day that you've continued in suspense. Without food, you've taken nothing. Therefore, I urge you, take some food. It will give you strength, for not a hair is to perish from the head of any of you. When he said these things, he took bread, giving thanks to God in the presence of all. He broke it and began to eat. Then they were all encouraged and took some food for themselves. And there's where you see there were 276 souls. And verse 38, when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship, throwing out the wheat into the sea. Well, there goes all the money. Now, when it was day, they didn't recognize the land, but they noticed a bay with a beach on which they planned, if possible, to run the ship ashore. So they cast off the anchors and left them in the sea, at the same time loosening the ropes that tied the rudders. Then hoisting the foresail to the wind, they made for the beach. But striking a reef, they ran the vessel aground. The bow stuck and remained immovable, and the stern was being broken up by the surf. Look at verse 42. Now the soldiers are in a different position. The soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners. Well, why would the soldiers do that? Well, if you are a centurion or you are a soldier in charge of prisoners and prisoners get away, you might receive their penalty. So executing them was the next best thing. It was them. It was either the prisoners or themselves, lest any of them should swim away and escape. But there's a problem here, isn't there? Because among the prisoners was a fellow by the name of Paul. So look at verse 43. But the centurion, wishing to save Paul, kept them from carrying out their plan. Is there any greater example, any greater metaphor that you've ever seen in Scripture, any living example of being the salt and being the light and being the influence while serving Christ than Paul on this ship? He wanted to save Paul. Therefore, he wouldn't kill any of the prisoners, because to order the execution of any of the prisoners was to kill all of them, and he didn't want to kill Paul. He liked Paul. He respected Paul. What about our relationships with others. Are we salt? Are we light? Paul saved dozens, maybe 100 prisoners, basically because of his trust in God. I hope that's the kind of impact and influence we're having in our lives. The seventh beacon takes us to the very end and back to the beginning, which is wiser with God. Now, the way that it ends in verse 39, or not in verse 39, in verse 44, they swam, they jumped overboard, they made for the land, and the rest were on planks or pieces of the ship, and so it was that all were brought safely to land. But I want to take us back to the very beginning in the first 13 verses. The seventh beacon says, wiser with God. You see, in those first 13 verses is where Paul says, actually, I think this is going to be a really bad idea to leave this port and try to get to Rome. And then all of this other stuff transpired because they didn't listen to him. And there was the voice of God all along, from the very beginning. Paul is the representation of the wisdom of God's word. I like the picture of this that is given in the book of Proverbs. Wisdom shouts in the street. She lifts her voice in the square. At the head of the noisy streets, she cries out. At the entrance of the gates in the city, she utters her saying, how long, O naive ones, will you love being simple-minded? And scoffers delight themselves in scoffing, and fools hate knowledge. Turn to my reproof. Behold, I will pour out my spirit on you. I'll make my words known to you. Is God not calling? I heard somebody say not long ago, and I thought this was such an insightful observation to make, that people often talk about the voice of God, how the voice of God gets drowned out by this and drowned out by that. And don't let the voice of God get drowned out in your life. And he said, where does this come from? The voice of God is literally the loudest voice in the universe. Isn't that true? The heavens declare the glory of God. The firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day, utter speech, night unto night, shows wisdom. God is screaming from the rooftops, I'm here. God is shouting from the cross of Calvary how much he loves us and how horrible sin is. Is anyone listening? That's the question. God is shouting. Always shouting. The problem isn't that God's arm is shortened that he can't save, or his ear is heavy that he can't hear. It's our sin. It's human beings going, nah, 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 nah. That's the problem. Paul is the voice of reason. He's the voice of God. This is a really bad idea. And what do? We take a vote. The majority says this is probably okay. We are going to risk it. Well, that's fine. Just don't be surprised when you lose the cargo and you lose the ship and almost lose all of the people. And had it not been for the Apostle Paul, they all would have died. It was only because God was on that ship in the person of Paul that anyone survived. They could have listened, but they didn't. Just like we could have listened many times, and we didn't. We're always wiser with God. God is always way out ahead of all the stupid things we're thinking about doing. He already knows the way this is going to end. He already understands the things that we don't about trying to stop a bullet train that's going 200 miles an hour. It takes 6 miles to stop one of those things. You know, so by the time you realize and wake up and pull the brake, what's going to happen? You're going to keep skidding for miles and miles and miles. And God says, hey, here's an idea. How about you don't do that in the first place? And do we listen? We count noses. We're concerned about the cargo. We're concerned about making another buck. But to what cost? What will it cost us? More than we thought. Far more than we thought. So this last one is really crying out, isn't it, to all of us, that we're wiser with God. God is always giving us good instructions, and it takes us back to that first beacon, which is beware the limits of human wisdom. We're not as smart as we think we are. God's ways are not our ways. I just ask a simple question in conclusion. Are you in the ship? Do you trust God? Are you in the ship? You need to get on board. Time to stop doing it your way. Time to stop thinking you're God. Time to stop thinking you're wiser than God. You're not. I'm not. None of us are. It's okay. You're in good company. God still loves you. And we do too. We just like to see you get in the ship. Now, is it going to be smooth sailing? No. It'll be rough sometimes. And you'll want to jump. Just don't. Stick it out. If you're a child of God and you're thinking about giving up, don't. Stay in the ship. God will take you there. We're barely going to get there, are we not? It's only by the grace of God. It's only by the blood of the Son of God that we get there. We're all floating there on pieces of the ship. But we will get there. He'll get us there. So stay in the ship. If we can help you and encourage you, would you let us know as we stand and sing?